In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
CRIMEWAV. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Consider yourselves warned. I
Hello, I'm Gary Phillips, and this is Chapter 1 from The Underbelly, my novella out now from PM Press. He's supposed to be old school, Savoir Faire taunted, flexing his shoulders and shifting his weight onto his back foot. Captain America don't live here no more. I'm telling you, it's through, McGrady repeated calmly, eyes moving from the man's hands to his face, locking onto the faux designer shades that Discount Desperado wore. You and Floyd are done. You his father, older brother, something like that? You're missing the point, Flavor Flav, McGrady said. My message is what you should be focusing on. Floyd Chambers is no longer on your loan list. No more VIG, office SSI checks. The two men stood on wall, smack in the womb of L.A.'s Skid Row. Unlike the street's more notorious incarnation in Manhattan, the West Coast version didn't boast of edifices as testament to giddy capitalism. The bailout around here was of the cheap whiskey and crack rock variety. The meltdown, a daily occurrence. The bottom feeder nodded his head. You're looking to take over some of my territory, that it? Don't seem to me like you got enough weight between your legs to be doing that, nephew. Don't appear to me you got enough left to run this block. Several homeless people had stopped to watch the show. Both men were about the same height, roughly the same build. But where McGrady's face was lined and his whiskers gray, Savoir Faire's decades younger features were untroubled and unblemished, the mask of the uncaring sociopath. We're done, McGrady said, beginning to step back and away from where the other man stood outside the open door of his Cadillac Escalade, a vehicle with 22-inch gold spinners for rims. Incongruously, Sam Cooke played softly on the vehicle's sound system. The thug was butter smooth and whipping out his pruning knife. The blade was vectoring toward McGrady's neck by the time the Vietnam vet reacted, forearm up. The sharp crescent sunk into his sleeved arm. What you got to say now, Negro? Savoir Faire gritted his teeth, expecting to easily pull his weapon free while whipping flesh and sinew. But having been forewarned by Chambers, McGrady had wrapped several layers of cardboard around his arms under his oversized flannel shirt. The knife was stuck. As Savoir Faire tugged the blade loose, McGrady drove the heel of his work boot onto the hoodlum's knee, eliciting a decisive crack. The asshole teetered, and McGrady landed a straight left to his jaw. He plopped down heavily on the contoured seat of his ostentatious lathe, his sunglasses askew. McGrady swiftly slammed the door three times on Savoir Faire's shins, causing him to drop his knife. Over the yelping, McGrady repeated, "It's done." He then sliced the hook knife into one of the Escalade's expensive sport tires. McGrady walked quickly away as it hissed flat and Savoir Faire screamed profanities, but didn't come after the older man. There seemed to be a collective disappointment that eddied through the small crowd. The dust up over, the aimless now had to return to the crushing dreariness of surviving. Making sure to move through the back routes, McGrady eventually made his way west on 6th Street. He hadn't been stupid enough to expect a rational discussion with the punk, yet had hoped it wouldn't come to violence. But really, why else did Chambers come to him seeking his help? He passed one of the specialty lunch trucks that were the fad these days in trendy areas. This one was called Goroga and featured Korean-style barbecue beef tacos with chili dogs made from smoked andouille, sausages, and those of other meats including rattlesnake. The truck would twitter when it was coming to a specific location. The aroma surrounding the mobile eatery was intoxicating, but the line was too long, so McGrady pushed past. His friend was in the offices of Urban Advocacy near Union and 8th, as had been arranged. How'd it go? Floyd Chambers asked cheerily. His strong arms propelled him forward in his ergonomically designed wheelchair with its slanted-in wheels. A residual smell of some pungent marijuana was evident on the disabled man's clothes. Mr. Chambers did enjoy his weed.
Just peachy.
Great, Chambers bubbled. Cut it out, Janice Bonilla chided. Urban Advocacy's lead community organizer was 28, medium height and honey-skinned, with several tats and piercings. McGrady put his hands up. It went like it went. You just stay off the nickel for a few days and that chump's radar and everything's gravy, dig? Don't worry about that, Chambers said. If things work out like it's lining up, I'm on the ones and twos, homie. He popped a wheelie and spun in a tight circle on the coffee-stained carpet. McGrady and Bonilla exchanged wan smiles. A month didn't go by when Chambers didn't hint at this or that scheme that was going to earn dividends. Bonilla's cell chimed Sambita by the band Kinky. She answered. Gotta bounce, she said after a quick back and forth over the phone. We've got a big turnout happening in City Hall over the Emerald Shoals bullshit. Goddamn galas in less than 2 weeks. The war goes on, McGrady said dryly. The offer's still good, champ, Bonilla said, packing files into her messenger bag. She'd asked him repeatedly to consider being an organizer with UA. He'd been sober this time for 8 months going. I'll sleep on it. Sure you will. To Chambers, she added. See you, Floyd. You telling it. Chambers replied enthusiastically. The three went their separate ways. Past 1 a.m. in the flop he'd scored in his army buddy, Red Sprinter's garage for the last few weeks, McGrady awoke with the night sweats, his heart thrumming in his ears. He reached for a bottle of whiskey that wasn't there. The jungle had gone hot and yellow in his head again. Booze, coke, the meds, the group sessions off and on at various VA facilities. All of it had helped and hindered, but none of it stopped the gnawing from returning. He lay on his back on the couch, unable to sleep. He clicked on the portable clock radio nearby and listened to Art LeBeau's Oldies Show. He once again read through the homemade comic book on stapled and folded lined paper his son Luke had written and drawn when he was 10. It was the tale of Lionhead Mose, a black jet pilot ace who crash-landed in the African jungle, found the secret Ruby Eye Stone, and gained superpowers. He fought several villains in the 30-page epic, aided by a sidekick, Roy Boy. McGrady, who hadn't seen the comic book in decades, was surprised to find it in the box of stuff he was storing in the garage. After enjoying the titanic climatic battle Lionhead has atop a mountain of the moon against Cobra Fang, he closed his eyes and tried to drift away, suspended between his nightmares and songs by the likes of the Midnighters and Bloodstone on the radio. An imitation of sleep finally returned as William Devon sang, "Just be thankful for what you got." "I'd be thankful if I had any shit," McGrady mumbled as comms descended on him and his mind went blank. 2 days later, a black and white jumped the curb in front of McGrady, and the uniform on the passenger side beckoned him over with a motion of his T-handled baton. The cops ferried him to what had been the Greyhound bus station on 5th and Los Angeles streets. Inside, amongst the luggage and electronic gadget shops, the LAPD had ensconced their skid row detail. The cops and the Denisons called them the Nickel Squad, as 5th bisected Skid Row. "How you doing, Sarge?" Captain Lauren Stover said, his haunch of his lanky frame resting on an industrial desk, gym-pumped arms folded. His hair had long since departed the top of his head. His office had no windows, and the only adornment was a large map of Oregon displaying old bus routes in faded red on one wall. Irritably, McGrady said, "Surely you must have something better to do with your oh-so-valuable time." When he'd last seen Stover, McGrady had been lying on the sidewalk in front of the Watchtower Bar. The side of his head was soggy from where it had contacted the concrete after being chucked out of the dive. And there was the captain, all grins and eyes shining like he was high on the Buddha, the tip of his spit-shine shoes poking the wasted one-time non-com. The police captain pleasantly asked, "Why'd you do it, Sarge? Why you kill Jeff Curry?" It took McGrady a beat to realize Curry was savoir-faire. "I didn't kill him. I defended myself." "Yeah," Stover began, getting off his desk. "Well, somebody broke his arm in two places, caved in his sternum, then pounded his skull like it was a landing strip at his crib in Ladera Heights. Coroner figures it was a heavy-duty pry bar that some bunkhouse butthead wielded on the unfortunate. No matter who the deceased was, a pious nun or pederast, Stover referred to those dead by homicide as unfortunates." "Bit out of your jurisdiction, isn't it?" Savoir Faire had his loan shark and dope hustle on from Inglewood to here. but you're my person of interest. Stover grinned and poked a finger at McGrady. My theory is, after your public altercation, you went away to toast your victory and hold up with some crackhole skank. Sexed up and blitzed out. You got the bright idea. You better do Curry before he did you. McGrady was inclined not to argue. What good would it do? He knew Stover was going to remain in the central booking, if for no other reason than because he wouldn't let go of the pass. When the hell are you going to get over it, Stover? McGrady said anyway. It's been so many miserable decades ago, man. We were all just a bunch of scared kids, for God's sake. Kids playing G.I. Joe. For a brief moment, glaring at each other, they were transported back to that bubble of time, seconds before that hellacious firefight in that no-name village off the banks of the Drang River. McGrady the Green Sergeant, Stover the Corporal, and his hometown buddy Mike Niles among the other privates in the recon. Mike, whom McGrady ordered on point that day, and who caught the first VC round, the high-caliber burst turning his brains to spray. But that flushed away like pissed-out cheap gin as Stover leaned his sneering face onto his. Have a good time in lockup, Sarge. Too bad you screwed up your life and don't have a family or your business partners anymore, huh? Can't hold your liquor, can't hold on to your woman or the respect of your children. Kiss my black ass, McGrady said, getting closer, teeth clenched. Don't worry, there'll be plenty where you're going who'll do that for you, homie. Both breathed hard, each ready to lash out at the other. The door opened. Get him out of here, Stover said to the patrolman. Get him the hell away from me. 16 hours later, Bonilla arranged for Gordon Walters, a public interest lawyer from Legal Resources and Services of Greater Los Angeles, who knew McGrady, to spring him from the Twin Towers jail facility. Thanks, Gordy, McGrady said, shaking his friend's hand, the large envelope with his possessions tucked under one arm. They stood in front of the facility on the 10 acres of the jail grounds. As tatted vatos and pretty girls in low-rise jeans with eyeliner on thick as spackle handed out colored postcards advertising the various bail bond services located nearby on Cesar Chavez or Vignes to the steady stream of mostly women and children coming in and out for visits. So far, there is no physical evidence and no eyewitness connecting you to Savoir Fair's murder. But, of course, the investigation is ongoing, Walters informed McGrady, spoken like a true lawyer. Walters, a handsome, walnut-hued man who stood 2 inches taller than McGrady, smiled. I'm not suggesting you did him in, M, but you wouldn't be surprised if I did. The lawyer clapped him on his bicep. I'm supposed to run you over to the UA office. Janice wants to see you. Walters dropped him off, and McGrady and Bonilla went to lunch. Floyd's gone missing, Bonilla said, as she and McGrady shared lunch at the bent clock on San Pedro after they'd taken the downtown dash to the location. You think he's on the run? McGrady munched on his couscous. If there was any benefit to the gentrification of downtown, where sweatshops converted to lofts and general relief recipients and the working poor were being squeezed out, at least the caliber of eateries had improved. She hunched a shoulder. The day after your run-in with Savoir Fair, Floyd's Section 8 apartment came through. I reached him on a cell and he was like, nonchalant. Still hinting about his big deal? I guess. Anyway, I kind of got angry. We managed to help him get the damn voucher in less than 2 years. They both knew of people waiting more than 8 years to obtain the designation, considering the obtuse Soviet-style bureaucracy of the housing department, Bonilla added. So he never came in to get the paperwork, and now his cell is disconnected. He chewed some more as he considered this. It's not like Floyd could get the drop on Savoir Fair. Because he's in a wheelchair? I know I'm not being all PC and whatnot, Janice, but come on. That muffler wasn't no pushover. She swallowed some of her smoked salmon and eggs and observed, a would-be player like Savoir Fair might let his guard down around a handicapped man. Stover said Curry's head was bashed in. That would mean he'd have leaned down and let Floyd wail on him. He could have sucker-punched him in the gut, and when he doubled over, bip, she brought her fist down fast like she was holding a club. McGrady chided. Sure, slugger. The younger woman made a face at him, and they chuckled. After lunch, he used Bonilla's cell to make a call, then walked over to the Chesapeake, one of the few remaining single-room occupancies in the area. He passed the Weingart Center on San Pedro at 5th Street, a multi-purpose facility serving the homeless. McGrady recalled something he'd read in Holy Land, both a memoir and an accounting of how the suburb of Lakewood, about 16 miles from downtown, was developed. The book was written by its native son, Don Waldy. Ben Weingart was a Jewish orphan named Weingarten. He was raised by Christian Scientists in the South. He'd left school in the 3rd grade and would go on to make his money in real estate, helping to build Lakewood along the way. According to his nurse, who also became his lover, Weingart didn't read much save the classifieds to see how his rentals were doing. Where the center was now had once been a hotel he'd owned called the El Rey, which back then had come to be trafficked by prostitutes. There was hope to be found in that, McGrady reflected. We could all make something out of nothing. He went up the narrow stairwell to the second floor landing where the entrance was. A security mesh screen door blocked his way. McGrady put his eye to the mail slot. Asher, the one-armed desk clerk, looked from the doorway back to the older lady doused in perfume standing next to his desk counter. She wore a 30-year-old cocktail dress that fit her like she'd just come off the runway. No hanky-panky, Asher advised Angie Bain, the one standing next to his counter. He waved his prosthetic pincers. No, baby, the 74-year-old former actress assured him. Her skin was leathery from years of imbibing, but still had a kind of haunted glamour radiating from her. He's here to fix my dresser. You know how handy McGrady is. Asher made a disagreeing sound in his throat, but buzzed McGrady inside. In one of Bain's two tiny rooms, McGrady went through the three cardboard boxes Floyd Chambers had left with her. Among the items, such as a crock pot and the best of the OJ's CD box set, was a brochure from the archaeology department at the University of Southern California and some flavored blunt wrap papers. What'd you find? Bain asked, looking over his shoulder, whiskey fumes palpable. She twisted the cap open on the short dog of Jack and had a healthy sample. McGrady had declined to taste. On the dresser near him, alongside her outdated cell phone, was a glamour shot of the ex-bombshell from nearly 50 years ago. She had reasonable parts in two Sam Fuller films, The Crimson Kimono and Shock Corridor, co-starred in several drive-in second billers in the 60s and early 70s, and even had some guest star work on old shows like The Big Valley and The Original Fugitive. McGrady held a magnetic swipe card with a familiar logo on it. You recognize this? He asked her, indicating the stylized lettering on the mag card. Nope. But you can worry about that later, hot stuff. Bain was sitting on the bed, legs crossed, patting the spread. There's no time for that now, McGrady pleaded. I didn't have to let you in when you called, Big Daddy. She removed her uppers and winked theatrically. Lord have mercy, McGrady grumbled, but he did his duty. Time passed. Why do you care where Floyd's gotten to? Angie Bain snuggled closer, kissing McGrady on the neck. You don't plan to turn him over to the fuzz, do you? He chuckled, kissing her lightly on the lips. It's not like that, Angie. I just don't want to be sitting around here waiting for more liver spots to appear. I know the feeling. He took her in his arms and squeezed. Damn, she shuddered, reaching a hand down south and clambering on top of him. Later, the sun almost down, McGrady walked around while he tried to remember where he'd seen the logo on the card. He found himself in front of the sprawling square acreage of the Emerald Shoals extravaganza of engineering, construction, and city hall lobbying. Part of the Shoals fronted Pico at Grand. A good deal of the work was completed, and soon there would be structures including a 75,000-seat stadium where the NFL's Barons would play, moving from the Coliseum in South Central. There was also a 15-screen movieplex, a music venue, restaurants, and parking structure partially above and below ground. Two times there had been temporary halts to the construction. Once was in the initial phase during some earth moving and digging. Some kind of old pot or some such had been found, McGrady dimly recalled, but he didn't remember what it was found, though the egg had been crawling around the site after that. The second time was due to the actions of community groups like Urban Advocacy working with public interest law firms. The groups had challenged Supercon's convoluted environmental impact report. That had just been a tactic to get the developer back to the bargaining table to up the percentage of local hires in the community benefits agreement. There was no holding back the tsunami of corporate terraforming remaking downtown Los Angeles and its environs. As Gordon would say, Bonilla had opined to McGrady at lunch, ride the wave until you crest or wipe out. Huh, I'll be, the vet mumbled as he stood before a large electronic billboard fronting one side of the site. The images on it dissolved from one computer-generated artist rendering to another, proclaiming the wonders to come, including a music club called the Thrush Lounge and a high-end steakhouse. In between, the developer's logo flashed. On the card that McGrady was holding, it was the stylized SK of Supercon, just like the one that flashed in between the illustrations he was looking at. How the hell did Floyd Chambers get a hold of the card? And what is it open, he wondered. Feeling purposeful, McGrady spent the next day crisscrossing Skid Row and adjacent areas trying to get a bead on Chambers, initially with little luck. He talked with several homeless men and women who, even without permanent roofs over their heads, could be found at regular haunts down to specific sections of sidewalk on specific street blocks. He finally went to bed that night with a lead, a bar in Inglewood. He slept free of the night sweats. Thanks for listening to the opening of The Underbelly from PM Press.
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by the Crime Wave.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.